Committee on Education will come to order. Thank you all for sticking around this afternoon. I know you're all glad to be here.
You mean we had a choice of whether we stuck around?
Life is full of choices.
I'm just asking.
So we have two informational hearings today. We're going to take about 25 minutes for each of them. So we'll be out probably around 2, which will give you time to get ready for the 2:30 floor session. And we are going to start by opening an informational hearing on education for Oregon's tribal students. And we'll start with Kathleen George, Phil Donovan, and John Tapania.
Good afternoon.
Welcome.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Chairwoman Gelser and committee members. I'm Kathleen George, Director of Spirit Mountain Community Fund, the philanthropic arm of the Grand Ronde Tribe, and I'm also a Grand Ronde tribal member. At Spirit Mountain Community Fund, one of our greatest priorities is advancing education for Oregonians. And that's why of the more than $60 million we've invested in Oregon's charitable organizations, more than $20 million have gone to help advance education through our educational nonprofits, our school districts, and our schools. Today we want to share with you what we believe is the first scientific look at how Oregon's tribal member kids are doing in our schools. Spirit Mountain was approached by the Chalkboard Project, a statewide educational policy body, because they were concerned about what they saw about tragically poor results from tribal kids. And in talking to the tribes, they found out that the tribes had never been able to take a look at how their kids, their tribal members, were doing in our schools. And so we decided to take a look at that together. Spirit Mountain funded the Chalkboard Project to work with Echo Northwest to take a look at just that. How are tribal member kids doing in the system? 7 of our 9 tribes participated, tribal members from all across the state, and what the study found was sobering and deeply disturbing. I also want to let you know that I'm here today not only as the director of Spirit Mountain Community Fund, but as a mother of a tribal member child that was unable to find the support he needed in our public school to help him become a successful reader. Despite this very capable child not being able to read at the end of first grade, we were told after dozens of meetings and dozens of requests, there was simply nothing the school could do to help. That intelligent boy is a fourth grader today, and he is now in a good school, but he is still struggling to catch up with his peers with the support of private tutoring. And there are far too many of our rurally isolated kids, some of them tribal members, some of them not, who desperately need our help. I thank you for your attention. It's my great pleasure to introduce Phil Donovan. He'll be speaking for Chalkboard to share their perspective on this work and where the work needs to go. And that'll be followed by President of Echo Northwest, John Tapania, sharing some of the major findings of the study. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Gelser, members of the committee. For the record, Phil Donovan here on behalf of the Chalkboard Project. Our role was that of catalyst and collaborator to work with these fine people tangibly. Chalkboard provided in-kind staff support and administrative oversight to bring this material to you today. It's the third report that we've worked on. I think many of you are familiar with the report on a deeper look at the black-white achievement gap in Oregon, and we also commissioned the Hispanic-white achievement gap in Oregon. And it's our hope to understand and monitor the progress of specific student populations in the state and with a goal of identifying their educational needs, what policy opportunities might exist. And we fully expect that this report is going to drive some very important conversations over the next year and that will help lead towards both community-driven solutions as well as state solutions. The tribes are meeting next week and we'll be out in Pendleton to continue conversations about the data, which has all been presented to the tribes at this point, but also to begin to develop recommendations for both their communities and for you Again, these recommendations will not be driven by Chalkboard or by Yucca Northwest. They'll be driven by the tribes. But we'll be there to help support that work, and our hope and intention is to support and advocate here in this legislative body next year. And as many of you know, I also have the good fortune of getting to work with the Umatilla tribes, and I'm incredibly proud of that community, the great things that they're doing, you know, and successes that they're having. You know, they brought salmon back to rivers where salmon had gone extinct. They're now the number one employer in Umatilla County. But yet, when you look at these sobering results, you realize more work needs to be done. And so with that, I'll close and turn it over to John.
Chair Gelser, members of the committee, I'm John Ticonia, president of Echo Northwest, and are privileged to have worked on this important study, first of its kind, really, that we're aware of in the United States, where federally recognized tribes have partnered with the State Department of Education, done a data match at this level of detail for individual students, and get a report back specific to their tribes. So really, as the Oregonian put it, a groundbreaking national study. I will step through the findings. First of all, I do want to say this is made possible by the fact that Oregon has relatively good longitudinal research data on education. There are some additional investments that the Oregon Education Investment Board is requesting in this session on longitudinal data. But I would say this state and this legislature should be proud about what's been accomplished over the course of the last decade. You're in much better shape. Couldn't do this in a number of states. This is the very first state, for example, where anyone has been able to look at the problem of chronic absenteeism across the state. No other state in the country can say that. So with that as the introduction, I'll move through. We're going to have a number of slides here, and the comparison groups will be consistent across them. The first group that we're going to be looking at are those students that we're calling tribal enrolled. So these are students who are out of the enrollment rosters of the federally recognized tribes in the state of Oregon. Their names were sent to the Department of Education. The Department of Education matched them up against the public school education records, stripped the names away, and then allowed us to see the identifier that they were affiliated with the tribes. We will compare those students to other ODE-identified American Indian Alaskan Native students, so other students across the state that were not part of these rosters, who, through school identification processes, checked a box to say that they were American Indian Alaskan Native. And then they will be compared to all other students, which also have other race and ethnicities. So those are the comparison groups. We're looking primarily at the school year 2011-2012, the most recent that was available at the time that we were doing the data match. Here are the number of students by grade. We had about 3,500 students. If we looked across all grades, you'll see the dip in 11th grade. That's associated with dropouts. And it pops back up in 12th grade. You have some students who are on a four-year path, but then some students that were staying for a fifth year. That sort of brings that number back up. But about 3,500 kids across the various grades there. In terms of demographics, we're able to see how the students that were tribal enrolled had identified themselves through their school records, and then compare that to other ODE-identified American Indian Alaskan Natives. So you can see that the tribal enrolled students, 74% of them identified themselves as American Indian Alaskan Native, and that's all. And the balance would also put in that they were either Hispanic, some other race. 8% did not identify as being American Indian Alaskan Native through their school records. If we look at the balance of the population in the ODE database who are saying they are American Indian Alaskan Native, 12% of those students are identifying as exclusively American Indian Alaskan Native. A large share, more than half, are saying they're American Indian Alaskan Native and Hispanic, and then other multi-ethnic, multi-racial categories there. With respect to where kids live by region, a much more rural and small town composition for tribal enrolled. 46% live in what the census, U.S. Census would call a rural area. So that is outside, the next category, town, it would be Roseburg. So you're living outside outside of towns. So you've got 80% in rural Oregon and in towns, relatively small percentage in metropolitan areas, suburbs, and the like. Clearly different, much more concentrated in small towns and rural areas than the other populations. Eligibility for free and reduced price lunch, that's the federal designation for lunch subsidies, roughly 185% of the federal poverty level. 75% of tribal enrolled students were shown as eligible, compared to 80% for other American Indian Alaskan Native and 50% for the balance of the population. So elevated rates of free and reduced price lunch eligibility. Special education designation, 17% for tribal enrolled students, 15%, and then 13% for the all other population. This is a slide, if I have to sort of stop and pause and let this one sink in a little bit longer, that I have turned to the clients and the funder and said, if there was one slide out of this deck you need to copy and put on a door and make sure that you do something about at the end of this process, this was it. Chronic absenteeism, which we will define as missing more than 10% of the school year, so about missing more than 17 days. It is something that with Chalkboard and Children's Institute help, we sort of shed some light on a couple of years ago. The Oregonian has done a nice job in the last couple of weeks running a series on this topic. Clearly a problem for tribal enrolled students, families, and the educators that are attempting to educate them. Double the rates of chronic absenteeism in elementary school. And if you look across all grades, a full third of tribal enrolled students are chronically absent compared to 19% for the overall average.
Do you want us to do questions while you go through, or do you want us to wait until you get through the deck?
Your preference. What?
If I let Representative Huffman ask his question and then let you ask your question, will you forgive me?
I will, but I'll wait because my question may end up answered.
Okay. Representative Huffman.
I'm thinking we're going down that road.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I forgot what the question... No. John, did the study dig into some of the whys?
This
jumping
would be
ahead.
One.
Okay. I'll shut up now.
The primary answer is no. This is a diagnostic study to begin with.
Okay.
The whys aggressively need to be addressed. But I would say that this next slide was one of the potential whys. Mm-hmm. This is mobility within the school year. 8.5% of tribal enrolled students in two schools during a year, another 2% in three or more schools. Much higher elevated rates of mobility than counterparts, and that will end up being a factor because, needless to say, transitions are going to take you out of some of the school year. I will pause just ever so briefly on this chronic absentee piece. And simply say what I've said before when we've presented this kind of data, that kids go to school for two reasons. One is to hang out with their friends, and the second reason is to feel successful and make some progress on something important that they feel is making important progress in their life. If they don't feel like they're successful in school and making progress on something important, they won't go. And you can't make them go if they're not feeling successful in the building. And I think the bottom line is, in many different shapes and forms. That's the simple answer to the question, and then there's a complex, detailed reason behind every one of those kids who's chronically absent.
Madam Chair.
Yes, Representative Wisnett.
Would you go back to the last, the next one?
The chronic absenteeism.
Yes, sir. Would you, thank you, Madam Chair, would you tell us how this compares to other states, and especially for the other, all other, and how does it compare, like Washington State, which has a large, significantly Native American population?
Yes. So the, as I've said at the very beginning here, Oregon is one of the very first states that has been able to look at chronic absenteeism on a statewide basis. And so consequently, you have a sense of your problem well ahead of other states. Now, Betsy Hammond, in her reporting for the Oregonian, I believe she uncovered maybe six or seven other states that she felt like she could make a comparison to, and she did in the Oregonian, and out of those six or seven states, Oregon was number one. If I had to guess, and everybody had perfect data, I'm going to make a guess 5 years from now when data is out that we will see that Oregon has had a problem in this regard. We do see it indirectly through average daily attendance data relative to the rest of the country. So that's the 2014 answer to
Thank
that
you.
Question. Suspensions, elevated rates of suspensions in middle, high school, and sort of overall across grades. This is a lot of numbers to throw at you, and I apologize, but this is this sort of the best representation I can give on achievement gap. And so what we're looking at here are sort of tribal enrolled and ODE-identified American Indian, Alaskan Native OAK scores by grade relative to that all other population. RIT scale point numbers are not easy to digest or understand necessarily, other than to say in a typical year, kids are growing about 6 or 7 points of RIT growth. What you're seeing here in the top panel is the difference in math, and in the bottom, the difference in reading. So you're seeing that those numbers are established in third grade the first time that we administer the OAKs. And they stay relatively stable over the course of the educational experience. You do see an uptick in the math from 4.3 to 5.8. So there is some separating, but that's not a huge difference. The way I want to characterize the achievement gap is this: think of it as a track race, and the all other group has started out ahead in third grade, that the tribal enrolled students are, you know, three quarters of a year behind them educationally in third grade. Throughout their educational experience, they're running around the track at roughly the same pace, but the tribal enrolled students are not. They're not catching up. They're not closing that gap. So the achievement gap is, it persists, and the school system is not making it worse, but over time is not making it better.
So in the at the end, you see that the number
Yes.
drops at high school. Is that because something phenomenal is happening for these
No.
kids in high school, or because there are fewer of them still in school?
It's unfortunately the more tribal enrolled students are dropping out, leaving the better achieving students there. So that is that's just a function of dropouts.
Thank you.
Representative
Breeden.
How significant is the difference between the tribal enrolled and the ODE identified? They
not very significant
okay.
there. Just a couple more cuts on achievement gap. The point, this breaks this out by geography. So we're looking at, now instead of RIT points, what share of students in math are meeting and exceeding. And we're breaking it out by rural, town, suburb, and city. And the point that I would make here is pay attention in particular to that rural meet and exceed rate, 41% for the tribal enrolled students. That clearly stands out here and is something that needs attention. And you see it with the math, the reading in the same way, that you have a lot of similarity in the other pieces. The other populations, rural town, suburb, and city, are performing in a similar way. Rural tribal enrolled students are behind their own peers in other geographic regions. This is a look at student enrollment in what ODE classifies as priority and focus schools. Priority and focus schools were created through the waiver with the federal government, No Child Left Behind waiver. The schools are the 15% lowest performing Title I schools in the state. The way to identify those, the method, it was an agreed upon method between the state and the federal government and the NCLB waiver. We went to go see what share of overall students are enrolled in such schools. We get 6.6%. We go and we look at what share of tribal enrolled students are enrolled in these struggling schools, almost 30%. So another major issue, I would say, this is a second slide in the deck to pause and say that on behalf of those that commissioned the report, the implementation of the priority and focus school system, the agreements between the state and the federal government in how these schools are addressed or turned around is something that is of should be of high urgency to the tribes, given the disproportionate enrollment in those schools among their members. These are four and five year graduation rates. These are for the those kids who were ninth graders in 2000 in the school year 2007-08. We won't have a surprise here, given that we had high rates of chronic absenteeism, and Representative Gelser already anticipated the dropout issue. But with 55% graduation rate after 4 years, 14% of that cohort went on to try a fifth year, and we got up to 59% graduation after 5 years.
Representative Springer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm not going to wait any longer.
All right.
Backing up, John, to that last slide, and I just keep looking at that, and frankly, I'm noticing head nods here. What does this suggest to us? What does that slide suggest to us? What are some of the thoughts you're pulling from that?
Well, what that suggest to the analyst is that there is according to the agreement between the state and the federal government and how they were identifying underperforming schools and their sort of underperforming conditioned on the socioeconomic conditions of the area is that there is a strong overrepresentation of tribal enrolled students in schools that by federal and state definition are underperformers.
I might also jump in. I bet if you overlay the Hispanic white achievement gap with that slide, you'd see another big segment of minority students who are a minority majority school districts, like Umatilla comes to mind.
Representative Gelser, Representative Springer, if I may, as somebody who spent a long time looking at these numbers that John has shared with us, I think these various fundings we've been looking at, they're interrelated, right? They tell a story that concludes with that 55% graduation rate. These tribal children are five times as likely to go to our most troubled schools. they start, so to speak, on that track John describes, behind the curve of their peers. Very disturbingly, from grade school through middle school through high school, less than 50% of these kids, on average, are able to do math at grade level. And a little bit better than reading, but nowhere near what a successful child needs to experience. We see these kids getting in substantial trouble by middle school. How can we be surprised that by high school, only a little over half are graduating on time? So I think it's a complex, interrelated set of circumstances that put a very challenging path to educational success before what are disproportionately rurally isolated children. And in those communities, we don't have Start Making a Reader Today. We don't have all the kind of nonprofit supports that exist in metropolitan areas. So if they don't find that help in the school, they're unlikely to find it. An observation.
And do you know, on if you were to go back, and you don't have to go back, but the attendance slide that show that compares the high rate of chronic absenteeism of tribally enrolled kids, what if you somehow put that over the top of the poor performing schools? Is that consistent with the? Do you understand the question I'm asking?
I understand exactly the question you're asking, Representative Gelser. The more I look at the chronic absenteeism crisis, I really do believe that is a leading indicator of a building that's in trouble. Leadership in the building. What have you? But there is not an environment there that is pulling students into it. When we did the study two years ago, and I was on Think Out Loud describing this generally, not for this population specifically, and we happened to call up a principal who had a very low rate of chronic absenteeism. He didn't know it. He didn't have that kind of statistic, so he was just looking at average daily attendance, and it was a cold call. And they said, so Dave Miller, the moderator, said, so why do you think this is? And he said, because regardless of how kids do on standardized tests, we make sure that every kid that walks into this building feels like a success. And if an Oak Score isn't telling them this, they're a success at that point in time, we're going to find something that does. And we're going to. Every kid that walks in this building is going to feel successful. So there's an awful. That's the kind of culture. There is also a household role of kids because there is chronic absenteeism, elevated rates in kindergarten and first grade. So there is a role to be sitting down with the family and saying, these early grades are absolutely critical, and we understand you've got transportation challenges and other kinds of child care challenges and work challenges, et cetera, but let's work those out and make sure your kid's here to learn.
Thank you.
Madam Chair.
Representative Huffman, and then Representative Springer.
John, you said you did this year and a half, 2 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm trying to think. I think Madras High School, or Madras, and I think I guess it was specific to the high school, was one of the targeted schools with the grant funding and stuff.
Correct.
They were identified at risk, or however you want to word it. That was probably maybe 3, maybe 4 years ago at the most. So I'm wondering if. You know, some of my concern here, if Madras has been successful, maybe is not reflected here. Any thoughts about that overlapping time?
No, it's important to look. I mean, this would take you up through 2011, 12. Looking at the Oregonian heads or individual schools, I think, for the subsequent school year. But you're absolutely right. They are in a process, and keeping close eye on how they're faring on these metrics is important, especially for this population. There's a sizable number of tribal enrolled students in the Madras area.
Representative Spear?
No, thank you.
So I only had one more slide, which is the post-secondary enrollment. So again, because of Oregon Department of Education's enlightenment, There is, we have an ability to follow kids into post-secondary, not only into Oregon's public universities, but also into private universities and out of state through the National Student Clearinghouse. This is the share of students who graduated between 08 and 2011, the share of those high school graduates who we find enrolled 16 months after their graduation. You'll see in 2009 and 2010 strong rates of enrollment among tribal enrolled students. There's a little bit of the story that your story, which is you have as many dropouts as you do, the students who are left behind are faring relatively well. So it's sort of a two-world story where you've got chronic absenteeism and high rates of dropout, but those who do make it across the graduation stage are enrolling at strong rates that could be stronger, and I would imagine, again, that tribal scholarship programs and other kinds of outreach are playing a role in that.
Thank you all very much. And I apologize, I think we're going to need to move on to the next panel because we got engaged and are behind.
Yes. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Toby McCleary and Lois Pitt. Or Lewis Pitts. And Cindy, do you want to come on up at the same time, please?
Perfect.
Is that okay if the department comes at the same time? Great.
Yep. We'll be here.
Well, I'm not worried about you. Welcome.
I'll go ahead. Okay. Louis Pitt, Jr. I'm a governmental liaison for the Confederated Tribes of Warm Springs. I guess as a successful parent, two out of four it doesn't surprise me. I had to, as a parent, focus. I want to just talk a little bit about me. Two out of four. I've got one in master's program up at Evergreen and another one that graduated from Columbia University in New York City.
Wow.
And both of them, chronic absenteeism and dropped out. They had to do it their way. But nevertheless, as parents, we never gave up on that. Is that, like I told him, I'm going to be the only dummy in this family, and their mother is a school teacher. So the pressure was there. The family was there. We dedicated the whole works. And I'm sad to say Indian country is, like, especially at Warm Springs with the economy the way it is that is a luxury. But anyway, I focused my whole life on being a present parent and also to make sure that they got educated in a way that fit them as tribal members. That's very difficult to do in state of Oregon. They did drop out of a very regimented situation, and won't say what school that was. Very similar to, I think, the boarding school is what they understood, and they had to do it their way. Thank goodness for PCC, Portland Community College, and their alternative ed programs. They got their GED equivalency and all that and got their start there. So anyway, very atypical, but they have set the way for a number of other folks who are following the same trail as they are. What I can tell you is what opportunity. There's an old Arab saying. I went to school with Portland Staters, and we got a real strong Arab program, but, you know, you may not be the smartest, the richest, or the best looking, but you got to recognize opportunity. What the opportunity here is that finally we've gotten to a point, we've gotten around the kind of the political correctness and all that, and Oregon is a, as you've heard, you know, don't hurt your shoulder patting yourself on the back. There's still plenty more work to do in a heck of a lot of areas, as you know. Governor Kitzhaber, I served on his transition team. It goes four more years, and with the facts as we see them now and the understanding that we have, we've got great opportunity, I think, to try to work with the governor and you folks. And part of my job is to I work What I do when I'm not down here is I work with 8 other Oregon tribes to just be kind of a staff person to help them out whenever they invite me. I do volunteer information now and then. And I also work with the Columbia River Treaty tribes from Idaho and Yakimas from Washington. So it's a thing where I do try to, when asked again, I do paint the big picture. And the big picture here is that I also see the big percentage there on that. It was the other folks aren't doing very well either. My gosh, 3 out of 4 are dropping out. 3 out of 4, it's just terrible. Because this is who we are. My ex-wife is a former school teacher. Oregon and Washington are notorious in how terrible they treat their teachers. And there's something we really have to do about that. And so it's kind of sad on that front. We have some good news in Indian country. At Warm Springs, we're building a $24 million K-8 to school. I'm worried about that because buildings does not make a school. Buildings are buildings or structures. It's people, it's ideas, it's energy, it's care, it's love, it's what education is, a very systematic way of trying to help people grow into who they should be and learn skills. You know, my kids are hammered with reading, writing, arithmetic, and the big one. Don't let anybody stifle your creativity. Don't let anybody take away your critical thinking that I did my damnedest to try to raise with my kids. And my dad raised me and my mom raised me, both very traditional people, in a way to understand two worlds. How do you live that? And so anyway, in Indian country, we always advance a little bit. For us, is that especially some of us Indian, well, all of us tribal folks, you know, we've lost, we didn't lose, we had taken a mile of who we are as a people, and it's always great when we gain an inch back. And so I was very happy to be a part of the working with Governor Kitzhaber to plant a seed and work down here to plant other seeds where this government-to-government relationship that we have with the tribes and the state of Oregon, the legislature, the executive branch, and we've educated the judicial folks to stay out of some of our business with treaty rights and such. And so, you know, they're a different bird. And this is one of the fruits. This is one of the great benefits that they're able to talk to you folks very bluntly as a tribal spokesman and to say, hey, we've got an opportunity here. We know where we've been. And we have, I think, you know, the fact that we all care is that it's a wonderful thing. So it always makes me proud to be a tribal member, and occasionally I feel darn good to be an Oregonian too. So I wouldn't be here like you if we didn't feel like we had some place to go. And so I think our place in America is that we've got to take that back again. You know, we were kind of, we in science, we were number one. And in critical thinking, creative thinking to help balance the world, we're number one. And what changed? So anyway, I think we all have serious things to ask, and I'm looking forward to if and when the governor gets back on again, is that I'll be pitching to my tribe about opportunity in this education. And so that's kind of the only promise you're going to get out of me. And besides pounding my other two kids to try to get to, well, they got important things to do. One's growing up and the other one's taking care of her semi-paralyzed husband. So they've got, I think they've followed the Creator's calling, and I'm pleased for them. They're a success, in my opinion. But education's a, you know, it's a wonderful equalizer, and we just have to learn how to use that as an American thing again. Okay. Thank you
very much.
Good afternoon. My name is Toby McClary. I'm a tribal council member and the tribal secretary for the Confederated Tribes of Grand Round. Chair Gelser and members of the Education Committee, I thank you for your time today and giving me an opportunity to speak before you. Representative Gomberg, it's a pleasure to see you. Thank you, and hello from the Grand Round Tribe. So the tribes of the Grand Round come from all over the Willamette Valley and most of western Oregon. More than 1,200 Grand Ronde Tribal members are enrolled in Oregon schools. Grand Ronde Tribal members represent about 15% of the student body in both the Willamina and Sheridan school districts, which are the two closest to the Grand Ronde Reservation. Our message today is that education for Oregon's tribal member students is in a state of crisis. For the first time in history, we have the data to measure the scope of the emergency and to begin to calibrate the mountain of work needed to fix the problems. The fact that it took this long to obtain the data about Oregon's tribal children is an indicator of the depth of the problem. Our high school student absentee rate of nearly 50% is chronic. Nearly a third of tribal students attend underperforming schools across the state of Oregon. Our tribal council recently met with Rob Saxton and Dr. Golden, and we received their clear commitment to work with us to retool Oregon's education system from the ground up. We also recognize that Oregon's tribal children are overrepresented in the state juvenile justice system and foster care system. We as tribal sovereigns own part of that responsibility, and I can speak for the Grand Ronde tribe when I say that we are committed to upholding our end of the bargain. We need your government-to-government support. Senate Bill 770 and the state and tribal government solution programs were made for complex legal, policy, and ethical problems just like this. New Oregon Education Department solutions must be comprehensive and culturally sensitive. Our cultures and experiences since treaty signing are unique. In the last session, you and the governor were responsive to Oregon's tribes and funded the new Oregon Indian Education specialist position. I raise my hands to each of you and thank you very much, Hayumasi. Now we need your help to make the most of that investment, creating a policy support team to connect Oregon's tribal leaders with the Department of Education, the governor's office, and the legislative leadership can and will benefit all of us. We must, after more than 10 years of neglect, finish and implement the Oregon Indian Education Plan. And tribal leaders need a seat at the table for the Oregon Education Investment Board. Oregon tribal member students are the product of 150 years of difficulty. Oregon's tribes are pulling themselves up by the bootstraps, and some of that work we can do on our own. But to move Oregon's tribal member students forward in the Oregon education system, we need the state to step up. The Grand Ronde tribe is committed to the difficult work ahead. Our unique government-to-government relationship should leave a legacy that is an Oregon education system designed to provide a quality education for the students of Oregon's 9 federally recognized tribes. Again, I thank you, Madam Chair, and the committee for your time today.
Thank you very much. Cindy, welcome.
Cindy Hood, Oregon Department of Education. The department is very excited to build upon the work that you heard today, and I want to echo the commitment of Deputy Superintendent Saxton to looking and studying the results of the study and then also continuing to meet with tribal representatives at multiple levels. And in fact, the reason he's not here today is that he's at an equity conference meeting with tribal representatives and others, so he's, you know, doing the work in the field. A couple of the things in the study that particularly stood out to the department was that I don't believe that we knew before the study was around the focus and priority schools. The demographics that we had and the data that we had did not single out students who are tribal representatives. So that was very interesting to us. So one of the things that we've done since that has come to light is start to look at our efforts in the focus and priority area to ensure that we are doing the best job that we can specifically for tribal students. Secondly, the other area that really stood out for us in the study was the chronic absenteeism, which you heard about today. We're seeing that across the board. We, of course, read the Oregonian stories, and this is something that we are discussing and would anticipate possibly moving forward with in 2015. Other areas that, so moving forward, we're exploring methods of continuing to link the ODE data that you heard about with the tribal students. So as you heard, you know, the study was about 2011-12. And for some of the reasons, like, for example, that Representative Huffman asked, is that we want to see if some of our efforts with, for example, the focus in priority schools, is it moving the dial at all? And so we're looking at how can we continue to do that link, but not in a study, but something that we would do at the Department of Education. We're also continuing to work with the OEIB and hopefully you all in 2015 to create and explore additional strategic investments that would specifically target Native American students and tribal students specifically. As we implemented the first round of strategic investments, there were some of the grants where the tribes are mentioned as key partners and that also target Native American students. One of those we're continuing to develop as we speak right now on cultural pedagogy and looking at ways of professional development for teachers in areas of the state where there are significant numbers of Native American students. We are also, like I said, committed to continuing to engage with tribal leaders on an ongoing and regular basis and at multiple levels, multiple meetings, and that kind of thing. What we feel like today, though, is that, and I don't want this to go by unnoticed, is that where we were at 6 months ago, we feel better positioned. And the reason is that in 2013, the legislature funded an Indian Ed specialist, and it enjoyed bipartisan support. It enjoyed the support of the tribes. We were in there partnering with the tribes to get this position, and we hired a very capable individual to do that work. Also, like I mentioned, we also have an Office of Educational Equity and the strategic initiatives that we can build upon. So we feel like we're better positioned when we see a study such as this that has some, frankly, very shocking statistics in it to be able to move forward with partners like the tribes into the future. So with that, I'm open for questions.
Thank you very much. And I'll take a couple of brief questions, but we do need to go to the next information hearing too. Representative Springer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Cindy, I think this question, not I think, this question is primarily for you and the department. We bumped up that Indian education specialist position from 0.5 to 1 FTE. That's still not much. So in what ways can that person, in what ways will that person be using this information to address some needs? Because we have a great report, and this happens in government all the time. We have a great report, tells us some things. We need to take the information, make decisions, and move forward. Are we going to be doing that? I mean, certainly there's some tribal responsibility there. There's some responsibility at the department, for sure. What are we going to do with that?
Yes, Representative Springer and Chair Gelser, no, definitely I can tell you that our Indian education specialist has examined the report front, you know, she's very, very aware of this and was involved with it before she came to the department, so she has a deep knowledge of this. Okay. But as far as how does this inform the work, so one of the things, like I said, is that when you looked at the strategic initiative bills originally, it doesn't mention a grant targeting Native American students specifically. So it's already started to inform the work, you know, because we felt it was very important to carve out monies specifically for cultural pedagogy around Native American students. So that's one immediate that I can give you. You know, secondly, you know, since she has started, she's, you know, continued to, you know, reach out to the tribes, collaborate with the tribes and school districts on how to best serve Native American students. But you're correct, it's a mountain load of work. And one of the things, you know, we're discussing is, you know, is one person enough, to be honest, you know? And, you know, even though she is in a team, an equity team, you know, and has a team around her, and she's engaged with, you know, like our focus and priority team, so she's that voice in the room to, you know, to consider Native American students' interests and tribal interests, you know, with some of our other teams, it's that when you look at a study like this, it is sobering. And so as we're moving into 2015, that's one of the questions we're asking ourselves is, you know, what are the staffing needs in that area?
Thanks. Yeah. Representative Hoffman.
And I might need a CTE grant or something. This just, and I haven't even had a chance to tell Louie about this because it just came about this week, an opportunity that I'm trying to connect the dots on. Warm Springs is a part of one of the sites of the federally designated unmanned aerial vehicle and system testing areas, and I just started the communication with Rick Molitor at Madras. Central Oregon Community College has a UAV program. We're trying to figure out how we can get Madras School 509J connected with COCC and Warm Springs. And John had said something about, one of his exact words, but, you know, students aren't going to show up for school if they're not challenged and not feeling successful and whatever. So with the tribal connection on the UAV part, if we can maybe, you know, give some of the tribal youth, you know, some CTE experience there and connecting with something, but, you know, we might need some funding to help put that program together, so.
Yeah, Representative Huffman, Chair Gelser, some of the last grants that we released under the strategic initiatives were the STEM, STEAM, and CTE grants, and I was just discussing it with our key staff person on that, and that grant had the most applications come in, 90, and we're not awarding 90. There's a huge need in that area across the state. So that's one of the areas, and I'll just make a little bit of a plug. It's one of the areas that the 2% holdback as a state agency was taken from is those grants. And so as we move forward with our priorities as a state agency, we place the strategic initiatives at the top of our priority list. I'm just, you know, that's just my little plug since you're still here. It's, you know, the CTE and STEM area across the state as we can, you know, better engage students to stay in school and to address chronic absenteeism. This is a huge need. Like I said, that was the most applicants we had for any of our grants. So.
Thank you. Thank you all very much. And did I miss anybody else? No? Thank you all very much. This has been very informative, and I know it points to a great deal of work that we need to do both in this area. I think we're probably looking forward to a lot of conversations about absenteeism and priority schools and what can we learn about how all of these pieces connect together. So thank you all very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. With that, I'm going to close the informational hearing on meeting education needs for Oregon's tribal students and open an informational meeting on career and technical education highlights. I would invite Brian Creek and Karen Phillips, please. Welcome, and thanks for your patience.
Chair Gelser, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Brian Krieg, and I'm wearing a slightly different hat than you normally see me in here in the building. I am privileged to be the co-chair of the Career and Technical Education grant program that you all set up starting in 2011. You're going to get some handouts up there, and I'll catch up with the numbers on those in a moment here, but just going back to 2011, at that point we'd been seeing a continuing kind of downward spiral of CTE in the state, and then that year legislature founded a new grant program to do jumpstart grants for schools in our state. We were given $1.8 million at that point in time, and we funded 7 grants across the state. In 2013, we were able to get a much larger appropriation, and in during 2013, we have given out $8.8 million now in 24 grants that are across the state. Also involved with that was in putting the language together. We have a grant advisory committee that has 16 people on it. It's half appointed by the Bureau of Labor and Industries and usually more of the business and labor types of folks on it. And then the other half is put together by the Department of Education. Rob Saxon makes the appointments on that half. Looking at what we had this year, we had a little over 21 million in requests for the CTE grants that were put out. 62 applications were received. A few other school districts sent in letters of interest, but just in the end decided not to apply. As I said, we gave out 8.8 million is what we had to work with, and 24 were funded. Of the 24, 140 schools are involved. And when you start to look at the numbers of that, with the amount of high school and middle school children that those 140 schools serve, it's about 45% of the population of high school and middle school students across the state. Some of the things about the grant that we structured in from the very start with the legislature helping to shape it was that we needed to make sure that we reached out to not just large schools, metropolitan schools, but that we needed to have a geographic diversity across the state. We needed to get rural schools involved with this just as much as we needed the larger ones. And so on the grants, the goals that the advisory committee has is a third go to rural, a third go to metro types of schools, urban schools, and then a third is kind of in the middle because we have a lot of school districts. So it's a little hard to toss a coin also and say what are they in their size and scope. We also have some diversity goals that need to be reached that OEID has out there, and I can note that we did very well with that. As you go into the charts here, we've got a list of the schools that got the grants there. And then the last set of charts, it does talk about minority students and economically disadvantaged and English proficiency, and as you'll see, we very much paralleled in the selections that we had what the actual numbers are in the state for averages on that. I think we ended up with a very good distribution this time. We had a lot of great grants, and unfortunately, we weren't able to fund all of them. I know the legislature has now pulled together a CTE caucus, of which two of your main leaders of it are right here, Representative Reardon Huffman. I know that we're going to be looking for further funding, and you know, I'm hoping more structural ways of funding to do these types of programs. I think one of the feedback we got from a lot of the schools is, yes, we're going to do these as jump starts. Yes, we're going to be sustainable, and that was part of the key thing. You're going to need to be able to keep this program up and running. So generally didn't go a lot to staffing. It went more to training, materials, equipment, supplies, those types of things. They also needed to have partners out there. And that was actually one of our other statistics out there. 260 partners are involved with this, industry types of organizations, small companies, very wide variety on it. The process also was very rigorous in the selection. We had 48 volunteers involved with that. Of over a third were from industry. We had people from Eastern Oregon and Medford involved with this. Every one of the volunteers who did this reviewed four of the grants. We also got together for a day where we were in small groups with the other folks. The people who did this committed at least 20 hours of time, not including their travel on this. And so there was a great outpouring of interest, and I think probably most everybody who was involved in that process wants to be involved again on that. So with that, I think I will end my rapid-fire presentation here, and I will be, of course, more than happy to work with questions here.
And a question I had for you, I appreciate the averages, kind of the comparing well to the average of the enrollment across the state. Given the presentation before, do you know how many of the schools that received the grants are themselves focus and priority schools?
Chair Gelser, I actually don't know that number. My colleagues at the Department of Education probably do. They've done a lot of number looking through here. But I, in seeing that presentation and being a Native American myself, I see that there's actually more need for targeting out there, and that hands-on types of teaching, whether it be for healthcare or construction or anything, does keep the kids engaged. And all the issues that were brought up before, this is an important component of it, and we know that many of the schools out there just don't have the resources to do this.
Great. Thank you very much. Welcome.
Chair Gelser, members of the committee, thank you for giving me a few moments this afternoon. I'm Karen Phillips, the principal at the Sabin Schellenberg Professional Technical Center, the unique center that North Clackamas School District offers to their students in their three large high schools, an alternative school, three charter schools. I'd like to briefly give you a context of the setting of the Sabin Schellenberg Center, and then conclude with some rationale for you to continue your focus on career and technical education in Oregon and continue to help revitalize programs as well as to sustain those. I did give you, ahead of time, you have a fact sheet in front of you that I would like to point out that's work that students
put together. So
and colleagues, that is in OLIS under our committee for today. Sorry to interrupt.
Thank you. Example of when students have career technical education experiences, then they can work at the level that professionals can, and you have that on that fact sheet. North Clackamas put this model together. I would like to mention, even though it's unique in Oregon, what I want to point out is the attributes of the programs that we have that any effective career and technical education has in place. You do not have to look like a Sabin-Schellenberg Center. So we happen to have three campuses. One was built with shops to be what we sometimes think of as vocational or career and technical programs, but I like to point out that half of our programs are in a building that was originally built to be a middle school. So it has traditional four-wall classrooms, sizes of classrooms around 800 to 900 feet. What's different but could happen in any high school as they get more revitalization grants, I hope, is that as long as a career and technical education program has a classroom to learn the theory and another space to apply, because that's the power of career and technical education, I would say you can create a solid, effective career and technical education program in any high school in the state of Oregon. You do not have to build shops. Shops are helpful if you're doing a manufacturing or an automotive program, but even then, you do not have to have that. On the fact sheet that you will see, we have 15 different programs, seven of them on our vocational shop-type campus, seven of them on the school that was built as a middle school, and one of them on a 14-acre farm. We serve in North Clackamas from those high schools that I was mentioning. We have about 5,100 students enrolled in high school, grades 9 through 12. The career and technical program serves in any given year from 3,000 to 3,400 students. And by the time they graduate, 91% of the students have taken one or more classes. So it is possible to create career and technical programs that are engaging to all students wherever they're headed after high school. As I was mentioning, it's really, it's not the whether you build another Sabin-Schellenberg, but it is about what the programs have in place. And so what I think are key, as well as what makes an approved program of study in the state of Oregon approved by the Department of Education, is that the programs represent high demand and high wage industries, that they have college credit available for students so they are aligned with the next step after high school. They have industry advisories, so when the industry changes, such as manufacturing becoming more automated, that we are changing the equipment that the students are using and that the equipment they have their hands on. And then something that I think is important as we're looking at what programs get supported or not is that we provide both career training to next steps, whether it's college, apprentice, or into the job market if you're getting a welding certificate, which we do offer. But we also provide that exploration for students at any grade 9 through 12. What do I want to do? Or if I think I want to be an engineer, I don't know what an engineer does. I won't know until you actually put me in that program. Another key point, I think, is that the context of career and technical education, whether it's a school-based enterprise like a student store, or it's an internship where I'm actually in a medical center working with an authentic site, is that it's the perfect place to teach the soft skills and professionalism that whether you go into the career of the career and technical program you are in, we are teaching the skills that all of the workers in Oregon will need wherever they head, and career and technical is the best place to use that. Lastly, I would like to say that in addition to putting those pieces in place, on the second sheet of the document that I gave to you, what career and technical education does, in addition to teaching the skills of the next steps that students have, students in Oregon, and this data was compiled by the Oregon Department of Education with a 2011-2012 data, is that students who have one or more credits out of their high school career in career and technical education graduate at higher rates and have higher rates on reading, writing, and math state assessment. So the the strength of what career and technical education does is more than just in the career area. I'd like to conclude with just a story to take with you that in addition to higher reading rates, higher graduation rates, more engagement that we were just talking about, how do you break the high absenteeism, I want to leave you with a short story. So we just created a new course this year that's a STEM course that combined our manufacturing program and our electronics program, and it's a robotics program for students. So they spend half of the year physically building the metal components of a robot, working robotic arm. They spend the second half of the year creating the programming and the electronics that go with that. To put that arm together, we purchased a 3D printer. As that printer is sitting in the electronics class creating those parts, the fourth year electronics students come into the class, see that printer working, and this is what I think we leave students. The fourth year student looks at that and says, you know, I'm sure I could run that. He said, I think I could build it. Because after all, it's just got a frame that's made out of these metal parts. It's got a circuit board that I already know how to make. And it just needs to be programmed, and I know how to program. Self-confidence is what we can provide our students. Thank you for your time this afternoon.
Thank you very much. Are there questions for this panel?
I just want to comment. If you haven't been to Saban Chilbert, go. I've been going since 1973. Karen was not the principal then. That was a joke. But it's phenomenal. They have broad offerings, and the kids are always engaged. They're well-behaved and polite and just into what they're doing. It's just a remarkable place, and so thank you so much for being here. Appreciate that.
Thank you. Others? Thank you very, very, very much. And with that, we will close the information hearing on career and technical.
No.
Nope. I think that's it.
No. We have two more. Reese Lord.
Oh, and, it's not here.
My mistake.
Yeah. Sorry. Please come.
Reese Lord and Charlie Hopewell.
Say it out loud so that
on the record. Reese Lord and Charlie Hopewell.
Sorry, my list just had the two.
And we're trying to get the manufacturing point of view.
Okay, great.
Sorry about that.
No problem. Welcome.
And Jeannie Yurkovic from Portland Public.
Great. Welcome.
Chair Gelsler, members of the Education Committee, for the record, my name is Reese Lord. I'm a senior project manager at Work Systems, which is the local workforce investment board in Portland, Multnomah, and Washington counties. And I'd like to speak to you today about the vital role that sustained and strategic investments in CTE can play in meeting industry's workforce needs and how workforce investment boards can be a partner in that effort. At Work Systems, we see ourselves as the glue between education and career, and part of that role involves working with industry to identify common workforce challenges. So about 5 years ago, we got together with the workforce boards in Clackamas County as well as our sister board in Southwest Washington, because as we hear from industry, what they care about is getting labor, and they don't care if it comes from Southwest Washington or Clackamas or Multnomah County. So we developed the Columbia Willamette Workforce Collaborative to address our labor shed's workforce needs. And as we looked at which industries to get engaged with, manufacturing stood out as one. 87,000 private sector jobs. That's 10% of the private sector employment in the Portland-Vancouver area. It also has an aging workforce. And so the combination through growth and replacement, the forecast is that at least 30,000 new and replacement jobs over the next 10 years. So we worked with the industry over the past 2 years to develop this 2013-2015 workforce plan. And if you open it up, you'll see the number one issue identified by industry is building a labor pipeline by attracting interested and committed youth. And there's a number of strategies that come up under that. Karen alluded to the need for exposure activities to get young people interested, but also the critical role of career technical education. And so the board, the industry panel, asked us to convene a regional CTE board to provide a coordinated venue to inform and influence CTE programs, to try and avoid one-off disconnected efforts. And so we worked with both the industry panel as well as CTE coordinators from across our region, including Jeannie from PPS, and identified some roles that this group could do, and so that's in that charter there. Things like advocating for CTE programs, assisting with strategic planning, looking at content and standards, and also one of the key areas of concern I'm sure you've heard about is around professional development and the availability of career technical ed teachers. At our last meeting, the two areas in which we decided to sort of bite off first, one is around identifying common performance expectations, so academic, employability, and technical. A lot of that already exists, but it's pulling it together to say, as a region, what are we going to agree and shoot for? And then secondly, advocating for CTE equivalency policies. And I'll talk a little bit about that in a moment with some recommendations. But I'd like to hand it off to Charlie Hopewell, who is the COO of Sunset Manufacturing and one of our key members of the advisory board.
Representative Gelser, members of the committee, thank you for having me today. My name is Charlie Hopewell. The company that I'm with is Sunset Manufacturing. We're a precision CNC machining company up in the Portland area. Serve customers outside of the area as well. Since we do have a brief time today, I think I'm going to focus my comments specifically into the equivalency area. CTE, I've been involved in CTE efforts in the state of Oregon for 30-plus years through the old SimCam days and so forth, and so I've seen us go through these various waves with the ebb and flow of manufacturing. But one of the issues that I think, and one of the opportunities that I see particularly today is really our ability to be able to fold CTE into the mainstream education experience of the child. I believe that all of you will be aware, but if you're not aware, that our state to the north of this, state of Washington, has done a fabulous job of really bringing CTE education up to the forefront, both through legislative as well as administrative action, and has actually tried to pull CTE education into its core curriculum so that there is an equivalency of credits that go all the way through the experience. While I compliment the independent programs such as Sabin and so forth, I think a reality is that within the school buildings themselves, any school building, a career experience is becoming more and more critical for our young adults and for our population and so forth, whether they are going to go on to a four-year institution or whether they're going to go into a vocational field. One of the critical areas for us is that they have had exposure to those basic technical elements of what it is to be successful within a work environment. And we believe that can be integrated into the curriculum. And in fact, we have not only within the state of Washington, but nationally, we have standards that are out there that can be adopted and that can be driven. I think the issue that we're going to be exploring and that where we need both this committee's help as well as the State Department of Education is really this exploration of equivalency. How do we build in to the K through 12 experience for the kids the ability to be able to take classes and not only gain proficiencies that will be helpful in our work environment, but also give them the credits that they can go on in their education? Many employers in my industry group that's a part of this council as well as throughout the state of Oregon are more than willing to help fund the education of people. As we all know, the cost of secondary education is just getting staggering for people. So what are the ways in which business and industry can participate? This may be perhaps one of our most cherished gifts, is that ability to be able to help somebody gain that practical experience as well as then the dollars that they need to be successful in their education and advancing their career. So my primary pitch today is let's see what we can do to actually fold the CTE experience into the mainstream so that we don't have to look at it as a separate building, so that we don't have to look at it as the shop class,
I think there are elements of that that are critical in that experience because you have the technical as well as the academic experience for CTE education. But the key is, how do we get it folded into the mainstream so that we don't lose sight of this? In my opinion, in industry's opinion, this is perhaps one of the most critical issues in Oregon's economic future. If we don't get this next workforce educated, trained, and ready, we're going to have an economic issue. Thank you.
Thank you.
Do you want to go and then I'll do it?
Yeah, and we really only have about 4 or 5 minutes because we have to be on the floor at 2:30.
Oh, great.
Sorry.
I'm going to talk fast. I'm Jeannie Yurkovich, and I am the Senior Program Manager for Career Pathways and Career Technical Ed for Portland Public Schools. The presentation, I'm told, is on the OLIS, and I'm just going to hit the high points rather than try and find it for you so that we can get you out of here on time. I concur with all the things that my colleague Karen Phillips said about the critical role that CTE and career learning can play in student success. What I can tell you about Portland Public Schools is that we feel like the stars are aligning, that we have these wonderful opportunities through grants. In Portland Public, we have a construction bond that is giving us an opportunity to connect our students on those construction sites and to partner with those industry partners, 40-40-20. I'm not telling you anything you don't know, but we are really excited about the opportunity. What I can tell you is that in Portland Public, we have a framework around career learning for awareness, exploration, and preparation. And our sense is that every student in our high schools, 9-12, should have an opportunity for exploration. And for students who want to take a deeper dive in an area, that would be preparation. And I liken that to the programs that we have at Benson High School. But we need to have programs available for students on all of our campuses. The interesting thing about Portland is that everyone talks about CTE, and what I'll tell you is that there's capital CTE, which are the state-approved programs of study, but there's little CTE, and those are those elective courses and pathway programs that allow students to imagine what the possibilities might be. So for us, we are engaging stakeholders. We've been engaging stakeholders quite extensively for some time, but we are looking at a high school action team, a diploma plus college and career committee. We're bringing our industry partners together, principals, teachers, and so on. And as we develop our programs, what we know is that we need to have all of those all of our stakeholders involved. If we decide that only the principals can decide what programs we should be offering, then because they know who's in the building and what equipment they have, then we're not looking at workforce. If we say workforce should tell us all, they don't know what we have necessarily on the ground. So as a district, we are looking to make sure that what we do is financially sustainable, that our students have equity of access across all of our programs, and that we are taking into consideration what the workforce needs and what we have in our buildings. The CTE revitalization grant, I just want to tell you how excited we are to have those dollars. It's going to help us develop our infrastructure and system around career learning. We've had a disinvestment in this over the last few years, so we are coming back. We are going to do things where we can engage our teams from our schools in industry, so principal, counselors, career coordinators, and teachers out in the community for a shadow day to learn about what's going on so they can bring that back into the classroom. Professional development, again, this construction bond where we can systemically engage students, build more partnerships, and really focus on establishing a district pathways advisory board to help move this work forward. For all of our students, we want to ensure that every student is exposed to career, that they can access little CTE, those exploration programs, if they choose. They can also access big CTE, those programs of study, and ultimately graduate from high school with an informed plan and graduating college and career ready. How'd I do?
You did great, and we have hit the time. We actually need to be on the floor to vote, so I apologize to cut you short. And I misjudged. I divided by 2 instead of 5, so I'm really sorry. And yes, Representative.
Just really quickly, if anybody is so moved, please talk to leadership and the co-chairs over the next few minutes of the session. Representative Reardon and I would love to move House Bill 4069, which addresses the educator component that we need for CTE. For some reason, it's a little stalled. It didn't have a fiscal. It was, but As you heard in testimony, we need to move the bill.
Great.
And do the study, at least.
Thank you very much. Thank you all very much. And with that, I'm going to close the information hearing on career and technical ed highlights in Oregon. And we are adjourned.